reasserts the legislative committee's authority to hold the Met Council accountable on any number of measures. And hearing this report from them on their activities is one step in that regard, even though the bill is not yet law. So, Mr. Bell, we welcome your presence here today and look forward to your being held accountable.
All right. Senator Rest, it is indeed a pleasure to be in front of your committee once again. To my right is Judge Shetland, the head of our government affairs office. Per your direction, I'm going to give kind of a 30,000-foot overview of the council, what it's a bit on its history and, more importantly, on its current operations and challenges. I am not going to focus on the transportation portion of the Metropolitan Council, as you know, Senator.
That's under the oversight of the Transportation Committee.
That's correct.
Yes.
And so we will not be spending much time on that at all,
right,
other than in a Q&A session. If different members have questions, I would be pleased to entertain them. We wanted to start off and just share with you briefly the mission of the council. The mission of the Metropolitan Council is to develop in cooperation with local communities a comprehensive regional planning framework focusing on transportation, wastewater, parks, and aviation system that guides the efficient growth of the metropolitan area. The council operates transit and wastewater services and administers housing and other grant programs. That is the mission that we have defined for the council. We are comprised, Madam Chair, of 17 members appointed by the governor. We serve at the pleasure of the governor, and our terms are coterminous with the governor. 16 members represent geographic districts across the seven-county metropolitan area, and I, as chair, serve at large. As this committee is well aware, I just came in front of it about a week ago for a confirmation hearing. Our footprint is clear. It was as it was originally authorized in legislation. It includes the seven counties of Anoka, Washington, Ramsey, Dakota, Scott, Carver, and Hennepin counties. This is an overview of the various chunks of the Met Council's activities. We have divided it in three broad areas, community development being the first. And there are four subheadings under community development: our livable communities grant program, housing and redevelopment authority. We are the largest HRA in the state of Minnesota. Our land planning functions. We have a major responsibility in land planning via our comprehensive plans. More on that in a minute. And the planning and the funding that we do with the regional parks. In our environmental services, we plan the wastewater treatment system for the seven-county metropolitan area, and we operate the wastewater treatment system for the seven-county area. And in our transportation area, the third major area of focus for the Metropolitan Council, we plan for our transportation system, both roads and transit, and we operate the transit system. The next area is our budget. For calendar year 2007, we have a budget of about $665 million. This includes operation, debt service, and what we call pass-through grants and loans from principally but not exclusively from the federal government. When you look at our operations alone, that is $453 million. Salary and benefits are approximately 60% of our 07 operating budget. That represents an increase of almost 3%, 2.9% from our calendar year 06 budget. Our property taxes, we do levy property taxes, decreased slightly, 0.4% from 2005 payable to the 2006 levy. We have $51 million in federal revenue for our HRA, and I'm going to talk more about our HRA in due time. And we have passed through grants for our parks operation and maintenance, about $8 million we provide for parks operation, about $17 million in our livable communities and what we call our TIBRA program. And then we have debt service of $82 million for our wastewater system. That's our largest area of debt service, and that's quite simply to build our wastewater system. Putting those huge interceptor pipes in the ground is a very costly undertaking. $43 million in debt service for transit and $8 million in debt service for parks. We also, in addition to funding part of the parks operational budget, we fund also a great deal of the capital for the regional parks. So when we buy land for the parks or build a building or renovate a building or do what we call land reclamation. If you look at the staff, a component of the Metropolitan Council, you can see between 2001 and 2005, we have actually had a decrease of staff of 156 positions. We, like I believe all units of government, are trying to do more with less, be as efficient as we possibly can. We, like other units of government, really needed to tighten our belts as a result of the $4.5 billion shortfall in our first term, in our first year in office. In addition, we've had many budgetary challenges, and it's always difficult to cut staff. It's probably one of, if not the most difficult thing that we do. But I think it has allowed us to wring even more efficiency out of our operations. Our transit staff is down by 81 in what we call our regional administration or administrative offices. We're down 30, and in our wastewater system, we're down about 45.
Madam Chair. Senator Pappas.
Mr. Bell, does that include, this number include bus drivers?
Madam Chair, Senator Pappas, it does. You can see in the next slide, this is just a quick overview of our statutory responsibilities that we have, and they are many. One is to provide a long-range comprehensive plan, and I'll talk about that more in a minute, but we do a great deal of, as I mentioned, land planning and parks planning. We also do a great deal of transportation planning. We do what's known as a transportation policy plan. That's a long-range vision of where we are going to go with transportation in this region, and a transportation improvement plan. And for lack of a better term, that is a short-range plan for things that we're going to do more immediately. We do this in coordination and cooperation with MnDOT, the MAC, and local governments. And the third major area of planning is our parks system plan. I'll speak more about that in a minute, but we have 53,000 acres of parkland. Our plan calls to expand our park system to 70,000 acres. We have 177 miles of trails. Our plan is going to call for increasing that as well. And, again, I will elaborate on that. In addition to the statutory responsibilities we have in planning, we also have statutory responsibilities for operations. And our operations are in three major areas. One is in our regional wastewater system. We have eight treatment plants. Our Pig's Eye plant is by far the largest plant, but eight treatment plants across the seven-county region. We have 600 miles of sewers, or those interceptors, those huge interceptor sewer systems. And as you can see when I talked about the debt service we have, the Met Council all told has over $1 billion in outstanding debt and a AAA credit rating, something I'm very, very proud of. Much of that debt, as I indicated, is for our wastewater system. In our transit system, that's the other operational component. While I won't spend much time on this, I wanted you to know that we have almost 74 million rides we provided in 06. That's up 6%. Our transit ridership is up 6% from 2005. And Metro Transit provides the vast majority of that. We have about 827 buses and 113 routes. Total employment and our transit operations is 2,580 employees. And the final area of operations is our HRA. As I mentioned, we're the largest HRA in the state of Minnesota. We have the largest Section 8 program in the state with 5,900 vouchers that we use in 99 different cities. The reason why the Met Council was given the HRA, it was thought that many of the very small municipalities in the third and fourth ring suburbs in the rural portions of the seven-county region, it was not cost-efficient for them to set up an HRA themselves. And as a result, there was the feeling that we should do that in more of a centralized manner, and that would be more cost-efficient. We provide rent assistance for special population, the homeless and mental or with who are homeless and have mental or physical disabilities. We also were part of the Holman Decree in North Minneapolis. We were part of that litigation. This was prior to my becoming chair, and we actually own 150 homes throughout the seven-county region as well. That's all located within that our community services area. In terms of regional development, I want to focus now a minute on our planning functions, our land planning functions. This is, quite candidly, one of the smaller areas of the Metropolitan Council. It also garners the most attention, in some respects, the most controversy. Each of the 189 municipalities in the seven-county region need to do a land plan every 10 years. Quite simply, they have to state where they want housing, where they want to put commercial development, retail development, and the like. And they submit that plan to the Met Council. And we view that plan based upon their growth plan's efficient use of four major infrastructure systems. So we say, how does the ABC community want to grow and develop, and how will their growth and development affect our roads and transit? How will their growth and development affect the efficient use of our wastewater system? How will their growth and development affect the efficient use of our aviation system and our wastewater system? And so we look every 10 years, they tell us how they want to grow, and we look at their growth's impact on the efficient use of that. And then, of course, there is a period or a process, I should say, of give and take. There are essentially four steps to that process. When I became chair of the Met Council, we did a development guide called the 2030 Framework. And that framework was that 30 or 40,000-foot view of growth and development in the seven-county area. Out of that development guide come systems plans and system statements. Now, this is done in very close collaboration with 189 municipalities, in very close consultation with the seven counties, in very close association with the various trade associations. So we develop systems plans and system statements for those four areas that we have statutory authority for: aviation, parks, wastewater, and transportation. And then we ask, after they have input into the systems plans and system statements, then they submit their comprehensive plan that will efficiently use or that is in sync with the systems plans and statements, and then they base their zoning on that. And so while this is a comparatively small portion of the Met Council, this is it receives a great deal of comment and no small amount of consternation from time to time. But that's the process, that's the system. And, Madam Chair, quite candidly, I think that it has worked relatively well, even with the consternation and agitation. By and large, I think this problem looks well. And with a few notable exceptions, I think if you ask the trade associations, if you ask the counties, if you ask the Association of Metropolitan Municipalities and most of the 189 municipalities, they would agree with that. The Metropolitan Council Development Guide, that's the first one of those. We have a couple of major goals there: to work collaboratively with regional partners to accommodate growth. And when people ask me, what's the number one goal in our land planning functions, it's very simple. The region is going to grow by 1 million people. by 2030. And the simple question that needs to be addressed is, where are these folks going to live? Do we have enough wastewater capacity for them? Is our aviation system adequate to meet their needs? Are our roads and transit systems adequate to meet their needs? Is our parks and trail system adequate to address their needs? That is an overriding focus of our development guide. To enhance transportation choices and increase travel safety and efficiency, and to preserve vital natural areas and resources for future generations. Systems, plans, and statements, the next rung down, we prepare three system statements. We combine transportation and aviation. I said we have statutory responsibility for four. We combined, we felt that transportation and aviation could be combined. So that's one. Parks is a second, and wastewater is a third. These systems plans, as I mentioned, are based on extensive, and I underscore that, consultation with the communities affected by them. By state law, communities have 3 years from the receipt of a system statement to update their comprehensive plans. And as I mentioned, they are due in 2008. Local comprehensive plan updates, as it says up there, are due in 2008. The council anticipates that this round of comprehensive plan updates will not be as extensive or as burdensome for communities as the 1998 updates were. Many communities were late submitting their 1998 comprehensive plan updates to the council. This is something that I am intent that we don't have a repeat of.
Mr. Bell, why did that happen in 1998? What was the explanation for it?
Madam Chair, there was a number of them. One, I think many of the communities would say they didn't have adequate resources to submit a comprehensive plan. I think many communities would have argued they didn't have enough technical assistance or direction from the Met Council to complete their comprehensive plan.
Is that the first time they had had to do that? I don't remember.
Madam Chair, that was not the first time.
They had to do it before.
They had to do it before. That's correct. But I think that they were, Madam Chair, this is only done every 10 years, and so the institutional history in many municipalities isn't that long, and that they didn't have that much experience
doing it. Was there any community which eventually did not?
No.
File a comprehensive plan relative to the requirement 1998?
Madam Chair, I believe we now have them all in. Is that correct? Yes.
We have them all in, and now we start over again. But you're determined that we won't. What is their due date? When do they have to have it into the Met Council?
The end of 2008.
So a calendar year end of 2008.
That's correct.
Have any of them submitted it already?
Yes, ma'am.
How many?
I guess one Prior Lake, is that right?
One?
Yeah.
Prior Lake.
They get a gold star.
So we have 188 to go?
Yes. Yes, ma'am. But we have, Madam
Senator
Chair.
Senator Roebling,
yes.
Is that your community?
It is, Madam
There you
Chair.
Go.
Madam Chair, we have done extensive planning to make sure that it is as pain-free as possible, as user-friendly as possible. These are, I would remind the committee, these are updates on their comprehensive plan, so many of them will be relatively modest. We are going to be proposing a modest grant program for municipalities that are quite small and don't have that level of sophistication. So I am quite hopeful that we will not have the lag time that we experienced in 1998. And to that end, the council is proposing some financial assistance to communities. Approximately 500 persons, including 200 planners, attended a series of technical training workshops that were presented by council staff. And so we've tried to get a little bit ahead of the curve so that people really do understand what the expectations are and the like. Another area that I'd like to, I think all the committee members are well aware of, but I wanted to talk a bit about is our Livable Communities Grant Program. We have essentially three grants in our Livable Communities Grant Program. We have a demonstration account grant that provides about $8 million a year. It has provided $74 million since it was first initiated. And essentially, this is to provide support to communities that want to do development, for lack of a better term, that adheres to certain principles, multi-use development, transit-oriented multi-use development, I think is the best way to characterize it. The heart of the city in Burnsville, Excelsior and Grand, and St. Louis Park are two examples of that. These are highly competitive grant programs that come to the council. We have an advisory board that looks at the criteria that the council has established, applies the criteria, and makes recommendations for grant awards to the council that we act on. The second is for affordable housing. This is about $1.5 million a year, and we do this program jointly with the Minnesota Family Housing Fund and the Twin City Minnesota Housing Finance Agency and the Twin City Family Housing Fund. We pool resources. And the third, we call our TIBRA program, or our tax-based revitalization program. That's about $5 million annually, and quite simply, that is to help clean up polluted lands. And that is collected through our fiscal disparities program. The first two are collected through our property tax levy. We do have an initiative. Madam Chair, I've informed you briefly about this initiative. We are going to be asking for more flexibility in using some of these dollars, particularly between our TIBRA account and our livable communities account. I also, Madam Chair and committee members, would like to take a period of time and study the livable communities program. Quite candidly, I'm not sure that it is now not just providing gap financing to municipalities and that it hasn't lost a little bit of that original intent. And so we will be asking for a bit of flexibility regarding the use of those funds, and quite candidly, reducing the full grant amount by $1 million in our property tax levy. This is a portion of the budget that I showed you earlier. The community development operating budget for calendar year 07 is $8.2 million, and as you can see, we get a great deal of this, the lion's share, from the federal government. Property taxes are about 31% of it, and the vast majority of it goes to our HRA program. The next slide is our regional park system. This is an area of activity for the Metropolitan Council that many are not totally aware of. In 1974, the Metropolitan Parks Act was adopted. It authorized the council to prepare a regional recreational open space policy plan, which identified land that cities, counties, and special park districts should acquire and develop for outdoor recreational purposes. This land, together with state facilities, should reasonably meet the outdoor recreational needs of the residents and visitors to the metropolitan area. That was the intent. As I mentioned, Madam Chair and committee members, in my opening remarks, we have just about 53,000 acres of parkland. When this act was passed, we had 31,000. We have 49 regional parks and park reserves, 6 special recreational features, 22 regional trails, and we have 33 million visitors per year to our system. This map that you see now illustrates the location of our regional parks, park reserves, and special recreational features, and also the Minnesota Zoo and the Minnesota Landscape Arboretum. It is important to note that we do the planning for the – we really do three things for the park. We do the planning for the park. We provide about 10% of the operation budgets for the park, and we provide capital. I believe it's about 40% of the for the park's CIP. We do not operate the parks. There are 10 implementing agencies the Three Rivers Park District, the St. Paul Park Board, Minneapolis Park Board that actually operate. Oh, here we go. We've got the implementing agencies right here. These are the folks that actually.
So the Three Rivers Park District, which previously was the Hennepin County Park System, explain the relationship again. I mean, they operate the parks like French Park in my district.
That's correct.
And so forth.
Yes,
Madam Chair. And the relationship between the Met Council and the Three Rivers Park District is what?
Well, the Three Rivers Park District, along with their nine contemporaries,
right,
come together with the Met Council, and they develop with us and what's called our Parks and Open Space Commission. It's headed up by Glenn Scoville. They develop the regional master plan for the parks so that the 10 agencies in our Parks and Open Space Commission come together and say, here's what we think the vision for the regional parks should be. In addition, they help determine where those capital dollars should go. So they help determine, and it is a very difficult, but it is a collaborative process. Who gets a new park building? Where a land reclamation project is done? What park buildings need to be renovated? It is a collaborative process, and that is funded by Met Council bonds and some state bonds. And so we put those funds together, general obligation bonds, in addition to bonds that we let. That comes together, and then we use that for those capital purposes.
And what role does the legislature play in that?
The legislature's major role is setting the levy limit for us for the bonds that we let, and then also letting some of the general obligation bonds.
So you come with your partners there. You come to the legislature for approval of those particular projects that would need state dollars.
Yes. And, Madam Chair, in addition, the legislature provides the Met Council with about, as I mentioned earlier, about 10% for the operations, and we simply pass that through. So we have a planning, coordinating role to make sure, quite candidly, that the parks are going to be where the population is going to be. That's really what the intent is, and that there is some balance between the various amenities at each of the park, that there's some geographical balance is really what the intent was. The next slide really just says what I just said.
Okay.
We've just gone over much of that activity. Let me move to our environmental services now, Madam Chair and members of the committee. As you can see from the outline of the various activities, we do a wastewater system plan, which essentially, again, we have those 600 miles of interceptors, those eight plants. Our wastewater plan really identifies where the heck we're going to put more of these interceptors and or any other plants. We also got authorization to do, when we look at issues of water supply, we did a water supply study to look at issues of safety and availability of water in the region. The 189 municipalities have to submit to us a water use plan as well. And, Madam Chair, as you know and as we have spoken about, we have another initiative called I&I, an inflow and infiltration initiative.
Quite controversial.
It has received some comment. Though I need to say I'm a strong supporter of this, this is quite simply stated, maybe we can put it up there, is when clear water comes into our system. It comes in sometimes through a sump pump, sometimes there's cracks in those pipes, and the bottom line is we are processing water at our eight plants that don't need to be processed. Because we have a lot of clear water that comes in there. If, in fact, we do not engage in a program of asking the municipalities to stop the clear water from coming in, then we have to build more of those big interceptor pipes. We have to build more wastewater treatment plants sooner than we otherwise would. In other words, we want to keep the capacity that we have in our pipes and in our treatment plant for water that needs to be treated. if we are using capacity in our pipes in our treatment plant for water that doesn't need to be treated, that's not a good use of taxpayers' dollars. And so we have asked cities to clean up their inflow infiltration, and all of them actually have signed an agreement to do that. Madam Chair, as you indicated, it's not without comment because there is a cost, but it is easier to do it at the level of the municipality than to build more treatment plants unnecessarily and to build more wastewater pipes unnecessarily. And so while it's a difficult proposition, it has to be done, and it is easier and much cheaper to do it at that point.
Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, Chairman Bell, is that what we call sewer separation? Or is that a different
thing?
Separating the stormwater system from the sewer system so you don't overflow the plant?
Madam Chair, Senator Pappas, I think you are referring to when stormwater gets into our system, and that really is a different problem. Okay. This is seepage that comes in either from the pipes or some pumps or in the past, sometimes water would come directly in. But the overflow we get from stormwater is really a different problem. Okay. And what we're asking cities to implement with our I&I will not address that problem. That's a separate issue and problem. Our wastewater system, as I mentioned, is 8 plants, and you can see where our the red lines indicate where we have our pipes. We have an estimated value of this at $3 billion. We serve 104 communities. And we process about 300 million gallons of wastewater per day. I am told that would fill the Metrodome many times over. I don't know if that's the image we want in our mind, but apparently that's what it does. It is a huge, very costly, very sophisticated system. It is a system that I think we all can be very proud of. We have near perfect compliance with wastewater effluent permits. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has recognized several of our plants as some of the best in the nation. We routinely receive recognition from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency and peer group associations for the work that we do. The Metro Plant Solid Waste Management Building earned 2 awards in 2006, a 2006 National Environmental Achievement Award from the NACAA, and a 2006 Project of the Year Award from the Minnesota Public Works Association. This new state-of-the-art facility has dramatically reduced air emissions, energy usage, and cost. Overall, the project saves the Metropolitan Council and its customers over $4 million annually in energy costs. In addition, the council received a one-time rebate of almost $1 million from Xcel Energy for installing energy-saving equipment that recovers more heat from the combustion process. I might add, Madam Chair and members of the committee, we are also working with the University of Minnesota, Dean Eldy at the university, about some other fairly exciting energy-saving activities, both in our wastewater system as well as in our transit system. Here is the budget for our calendar year budget is $665 million. And you can see what the sources are. They are from our municipal wastewater charge. We don't charge the end customer for processing wastewater. We charge a city, and the city, we're in 104 municipalities, we charge the city. And the city charges the end customer, so no one has on their bill a charge from us. We also have a SAC charge, and that is the cost to connect to the system. So as a new home is built, there's a charge to hook up to our system, which is $1,675 per residential equivalent connection. We also have a third charge. There's a lot of industrial use of our system, so the ABC industry may want to use our system to clean up waste water that they may have. And then we have interest earning from grants and the like. But basically, it's this, we charge to cities, it's the SAC charge, and it's the charge that we make to industry when they want to use our system. Here is what our charges are, our wastewater charges, and you can see what has happened to our wastewater charges. This is a chart I'm very proud of. Not only do I think we run a world-class system, but it is one that is not kept up with the growth of inflation. It is lower than the growth of inflation, and it's also lower than many of our peer cities as well. You can see on this slide, this is what the charges are from some other representative samples across the country. So in sum, I think we have a world-class wastewater operation that is provided at exceptional value to the residents of the seven-county area.
Mr. Bell, how do the or will you comment when you explain this map, how the wastewater charges relate to the retail rate?
This is the rate of the Twin Cities area that we will charge on average a customer, and Bill, correct me if I'm wrong, in a city, and then that gets passed on to the actual homeowner or
and
business.
But the $141.8 million on the wastewater charges it relates to the $192 how? That just a division or
the 146 the 146 dollars go to this slide but it's this charge here that charge the wastewater municipal wastewater charge the $146 million here's how this flows that goes to Eden Prairie, or the Eden Prairie gets their piece of it. And then Eden Prairie divides that up between their businesses and homeowners. Now, what needs to be understood is that Eden Prairie, I'm not picking on them, but Eden Prairie or Lakeville or Shakopee sometimes upcharges this amount.
I see, which could get to $192.
That's correct.
That's rather
exactly
than...
Right. It would be 152 if there was no increase.
That's what I wanted to know.
Yeah, it would be 100.
If they accepted just their charge from the Met Council, it would be $152.60 per
resident.
For 100,000 gallons per year, it would be $152.60.
But
that's
instead,
that's approximately the cost of a single family home.
But instead, our average rate is $192.
That's correct.
Okay.
And that's because of the upcharge that the cities may add on to that.
Okay.
Madam Chair?
Senator Roebling.
Mr. Chairman, is that like for billing or what other benefits, add-on benefits, is the city providing?
Mr. Bell?
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, I'm going to ask Bill Moore to answer that question because I think it's for many different things. Mr. Moore heads up our environmental services.
Madam Chair and members.
Mr. Moore, if you identify yourself, please, for the record.
William Moore, General Manager, Environmental Services for the Metropolitan Council. Madam Chair, the cost that we're talking about that the city adds, that's for their operation and maintenance and administration of their local sewer system. So the Metropolitan Council has the large pipes that go through and provide service to a community, but within a community, there's probably 10 times as much pipage in a community for the local collection system, and so it is for their cost to operate and maintain that local system that then ties into ours.
So it's just that the Metropolitan Council's wastewater treatment services account for $152 of the $192 that then cities add on to that, or at least for 2006 or 7.
We bring the pipe to the city boundary, and then the city brings the pipe, many pipes, elsewhere within their jurisdiction.
Thank you. That's very helpful.
Madam Chair.
Senator Gimsey.
Madam Chair, Commissioner, just for clarification, since I am a home builder, the $1,675 connection fee for each new home, now is that something you charge, that you receive, money you receive, and then is there an addition, I would imagine, on the part of the city?
Chair Bell.
Mr. Moore, I'm going to ask Mr. Moore to answer that.
Mr. Moore.
Chair, committee members, the $1,675 is the fee that will come to the Metropolitan Council. It's really tied into the building permits that will be issued by the city, and then the city will collect the money and pass on the $1,675 to us. Some cities do also add on an additional cost for their own systems.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Bell, it looks like there's one more slide right
yes,
there.
Yes, there is, Madam Chair, and that's what our capital budget. This is a 10-year CIP equaling $1.5 billion expansion, or growth is 49% of this. This is to expansion of our wastewater plants and new interceptor systems, rehabilitation, maintaining investment in existing infrastructure is 45% of it, and quality improvements, energy efficiency, increasing the level of treatment, or reducing operational and maintenance costs is the balance of it. And, Madam Chair, that ends my presentation.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bell. Are there comments or questions for the Chair of Met Council? And we look forward to holding you accountable on more than one occasion during this legislative session, but we do appreciate your coming before us today and giving us a general view of the operations of Met Council, for which those portions of which for which this committee has jurisdiction.
Madam Chair, we appreciate the opportunity and would be willing to come up and testify on any issue or matter of concern. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I would direct members' attention to the minutes from the January 24th meeting. There is a feature in the software that repeats certain sections of the minutes. And so the bottom page of the first page is repeated at the top of the second page, but we'll just eliminate that for the record. And Senator Larson then would move adoption of the minutes from January 24th. Is there any discussion? All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. We have two bills to hear.
Madam Chair, one correction. I think yes. AFSCME is misspelled.
Beg pardon? Where?
The bottom of page one.
Oh, thank you. We'll make that.
And on page two as well.
Well, that's just a repetition of the page one that I mentioned. Thank you very much for calling it to our attention. I've asked Senator, since these two bills are mine that are coming up now, I've asked Senator Gerlach and Senator Lurie's absence today if he would chair the meeting.
Okay, members, so we're going to have Senate File 38, and if you'd like to move your own bill.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that Senate File 38 be recommended to pass, and as far as I know, it has no other stop, so it would go to the floor if the committee acts favorably on it.
Okay. And you have no other, you have no author's amendments?
No.
So, all right, Senator Rester, if you want to explain your bill.
Mr. Chairman and members, Senate File 38 is the Great Lakes St. Lawrence River Water Resources Compact. This is a bill that represents the work of a number of years and will govern diversions from the Great Lakes Basin. Following ratification of the compact by the eight legislatures that comprise the Great Lakes states, I'll just make a note about the overview that Mr. Bodden provided. He mentions that the Great Lakes states plus Ontario and Quebec. And, of course, this is not a treaty between the United States and Canada. So the agreement between by Ontario and Quebec are not part of the compact itself. But Ontario and Quebec have decided that they will go along with the compact once it has been ratified and approved by Congress, and they have been discussants in the development of it as well. The articles in the bill have a definition section. There is a council that is created to oversee the provisions of the compact. In the third article, the powers of this council, which it's made up by the governors or their designees of each of the states. The fourth article is the actual water sources program, and I would direct your attention to the five issues that Mr. Bodden has summarized on the first page of the. Of the overview of this bill. Articles 5 and 6 treat the way in which the tribes will be involved and the way in which the public will be involved in commenting on any changes or applications for water diversions. Article 7 deals with enforcement, and Articles 8 Article 8 deals with the some additional provisions with relationships to other laws, as well as Article 9. Currently, water diversions from the Great Lakes Basin, which comprise the Great Lakes, are 18% of the freshwater supply in the entire world. Are governed by a federal statute called WERDA, which was passed in 1986. It has been very quickly deemed by the Council of Great Lakes Governors, eight governors. Even when governors changed, the Council of Great Lakes Governors has supported moving toward a new agreement, a new compact with one another to deal with water diversions. And what they've come up with is a document that was signed by all eight Great Lakes governors in December of 2005. The next step is the ratification of that compact by each of the Great Lakes states. The Minnesota has played a major role in developing the compact and also in showing the way for what is good policy regarding permitting for water appropriations. The Minnesota has had a system of water appropriations of permitting since 1937. It is well developed and it is well accepted in our state. Some of the other Great Lakes states have very inconsistent patterns of water permitting, or quite frankly, almost none at all. The compact itself and its provisions is not as restrictive, quite frankly, as Minnesota's own, or as precise as Minnesota's own laws. And so, in adopting it, we are not putting a higher standard for Minnesota Minnesota's permitting process than already exists. The compact needs to be passed as is by each of the states, and that's why, Mr. Chairman, there are no amendments to it. It acts like a treaty among the states, even though it is not. That kind of agreement is called a compact. And following the adoption by the states, it also needs to be approved by the federal Congress before it goes into effect. The Committee on the Environment passed it unanimously. It is supported by certainly by the our Department of DNR, and Mr. Lacasmo is here to testify in its on its behalf. Give you a little bit more background about Minnesota's participation, and the major environmental organizations in Minnesota are also in support of it, as you can see from the list of testifiers. There are a couple of handouts in the in your packets for you, and I hope you'll take the opportunity to look at them. In particular, the map that talks about the different watersheds that exist in Minnesota. We have the Great Lakes one, the Lake Superior watershed that's part of the Great Lakes Basin, but then we also have two others, and fortunately for us, none of them are in competition with one another with regard to use by major industries. I've also provided a typical kind of resolution from the environmental organizations, this one by the Minnesota Conservation Federation, supporting the Great Lakes Compact, and also some information about the, I'm sorry, it's not all that, it's too dark, but I hope you can see it, the hydrology, all the different water facts about the Great Lakes, and of course, you can see that Lake Superior is the deepest of them, and is and has the largest retention of water among the Great Lakes, among the five Great Lakes. Quebec, by the way, is a stakeholder in this compact, and for them an agreement, not because it touches a Great Lake, as Ontario does, but because it is the St. Lawrence River runs through it. There are also some kind of questions and answers about the Great Lakes on one of the slides there that I hope you'll find of interest. With that, Mr. Chairman, I would ask for Mr. Lacasmo to come forward, and if you have questions about the details in the compact, I'll stand for questions on that as well. Essentially, the point of the compact is there will be no diversions from the Great Lakes Basin outside of the basin with extremely limited exceptions from the communities that straddle the Great Lakes. But no Great Lakes water is going to go to Arizona, nor is it going to go to China. Mr. Lacasmo.
Thank you. Mr. Lacasmo, if you could please state your full name and who you represent for the record.
Mr. Chairman, Kent Lacasmo, I'm the Director of the Division of Waters for Minnesota DNR. And Senator Rest gave a pretty good summary of what's in this bill. This is a governor's initiative. It is something that we've worked on from the state agency since a long time, since probably before 1999. There was an agreement signed by Governor Ventura to develop a simple, durable, efficient agreement to protect the waters of the Great Lakes. Now, I don't think I can tell you that this is simple, but it is durable and it would be efficient. One of the concerns about this, as Senator Rest said, we had I'll give you a little bit of history first. In 1985, there was a request to take Lake Superior water to Montana with the coal slurry pipeline. That prompted the development of the Great Lakes Charter, which was a good faith agreement between the states. Right following that was the passage of the Water Resources Development Act of 1986, which prohibits any diversion out of the Great Lakes Basin without first getting each governor's approval. So it essentially gave veto authority to the governors. But it didn't provide any process, any review, any mechanisms for input and or any standards. So there was a feeling that that was subject to challenge, and we needed to have something that was more defensible. So we've been working through this process with the other seven Great Lakes states, and then with a parallel agreement with the two provinces. So we've, in Minnesota, this has been somewhat easier for Minnesota since we have a pretty comprehensive water appropriation statute. For example, we require permits at a threshold of 10,000 gallons a day, and this compact kicks in for just a registration of water use at 100,000 gallons a day, and for having any permits that would require regional review, it's 5 million gallons a day. So the thresholds that are used within this document are quite large. Right now, with WERDA 86, you essentially have no diversions allowed outside of the basin. You have that veto authority that exists. And through the development of this, we talked for a long time over the years about having what type of voting threshold you would have to approve any diversions. And there was concern over that on having a unanimous vote versus some other level of vote, majority, supermajority, whatever. That was an insurmountable conflict between the states, and we got around that by essentially in this document in section, I think it's 4.9, it prohibits diversions out of the basin, but it provides for some exceptions. And if you look at the, I believe everybody has the handout that's got a yellow title on it. If you look at the last page in that handout, it shows the Lake Superior watershed with the community boundaries shown in pink. And we have communities that are both on both sides of the watershed divide. And that's no different than Akron, Ohio is similar, that it has a watershed divide going through the middle of town. So there was a recognition in the development of this that we needed to be able to responsibly manage the water of the Great Lakes, yet allow for reasonable use at the border. And this is along the Iron Range in Minnesota, which is a highly altered watershed. What is provided for in this agreement, though, is existing uses are grandfathered in. You will see in the compact that the Chicago diversion is one of the large diversions that exists in the watershed. That's allowed by a Supreme Court decree from the early of last century, you know, in the 1800s. And we've had debates and mediation processes to keep them on track and consistent with that decree. But they're accepted from this agreement because that Supreme Court decree will guide them. So we are eliminating diversions, which are already dealt with through WERDA 86. So this actually provides some guidance and it provides some exceptions for these straddling communities or straddling counties even. It's not as easy to say, you know, absolutely no diversions out of the basin because you have these little bit leaky borders where you have communities that straddle. On the consumptive use side, where the consumptive use decisions are left with the state, regardless of the quantity of water ultimately consumed. So there was concern through the discussion on how we were going to manage that in the final decisions now. If it is a large consumptive use that triggers the regional review, we would accept comments from the other nine parties, the two provinces and the other seven states, but then the final decision still rests with Minnesota. So we have that ongoing authority. I do have a page in here on page 6 that goes through Minnesota's program. We have a priority system for water use. We already deal with the consumptive uses and diversions. that actually some of those right now come back to the legislature for a specific approval. So that's we don't foresee any changes in Minnesota law that's needed by the adoption of this, and that is far different than other states. Other states have are going to have to make some changes in their regulatory framework or initiate a regulatory framework to provide for meeting the terms of this compact. And we did meet a number of times publicly with various groups. We've held a number of meetings throughout Minnesota. We've met with the chamber, Minnesota Chamber, several times, and they don't have objections to this. I'm not sure if they're back in the audience, but I did talk to Tony Quillis from the Minnesota Chamber earlier today, and we aren't aware of any objections for this bill. And I'll stand for questions.
Okay. Members, questions? Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Lacazmo, on page 29, the repealer of inconsistent acts. In other words, we have none that you're aware of.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Marty, that's correct. At some point, we could look at repealing what we've put in law dealing with the charter, the good faith agreement from 1985, although that's not that would not be necessary. I mean, it still functions and it doesn't contradict, but it would support that. But there are no other repealers that I'm aware of.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Marty, too, since the compact is not effective until all the states pass it and so on, we do have a good window of time to be deliberate and thoughtful about any kind of additional implementing provisions that we want to take a look at, and I would anticipate that is still going to be several years out.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions there? Okay, Senator Roebling, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It says here that this is an enforceable agreement. I'm wondering who will do the enforcement, and what would some of the consequences be if the agreement is not kept?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Roebling, first, we need all eight states to pass this and then get Congress assent. And there are so right now there's a prohibition against diversion. Well, essentially, you need all eight governors' approval to get to have a diversion. So this actually, I suppose, loosens that a little bit. It provides a way for communities that have states that have a straddling community to seek approval. So there is this provides a mechanism with some standards that are able to be judged for anybody to use. The penalties if a state would not pass standards to deal with the consumptive use requirements, the threshold is lowered from 5 million gallons a day. They have 5 years to pass it. If they don't, the threshold is reduced from 5 million gallons a day to 100,000 gallons a day. But in Minnesota, we already have 10,000 gallons a day for a permit threshold or standard. So we aren't envisioning that. And there's also the provision then for citizen suits if there's other entities that would wish to pursue an action.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Seeing none, then, Senator Rest, I've got some other people on the list here, Allison Wolf, Gary Botzik, and Dave Dempsey. Do they want to testify if that's required or not?
I don't know that that's necessary, but okay. if there was no opposition to it in the Environment Committee, and these folks testified there, but they certainly are available for questions.
Okay. Do members have any questions of any of those other individuals? No? Okay. Any questions for Senator Rest? Nope. Did you want to conclude with anything?
Mr. Chairman, if you would also ask if there's any additional comment from the public.
Oh, okay. Is there any additional comment from the public?
Well, then, Mr. Chairman, I would move that Senate File 38 be recommended to pass.
Senator Rest renews her motion that Senate File 38 be passed by this committee and sent to the floor. Any discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Say aye.
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 Those opposed? The motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Chairman, I also have Senate File 123.
And members, Senate File 123 was heard in the Elections Subcommittee, and Senator Larson presided over those proceedings. So if you want, either you can move it over to Senator Larson. It's your committee report that's coming forth from the subcommittee. Is that appropriate?
Senator Larson needs to move adoption of the subcommittee
report. Okay. I move adoption of the subcommittee report.
Okay. Senator Larson moves adoption of the subcommittee report for Senate File 123. Discussion? None. All those in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? The committee report is adopted. So we have Senate File 123 then in front of us.
Thank you,
Senator
Mr.
Russell,
Chairman.
Want to explain?
Senate File 123 addresses some campaign finance issues. First of all, it really goes to the heart of disclosure of extraordinary contributions that are made after the reporting filing deadline has passed. Legislators are familiar with that requirement because if we, during that period, let's say last year it was August 21st for the primary, that's the reporting cutoff date. If at any time after that, prior to the election date, we receive a contribution in excess of $400, we need to make a report to the Campaign Finance Board within 48 hours. It is not a matter of accepting the contribution. It is a matter only of disclosing it. The with regard to legislators, we make two changes to the general statute that would affect them. One of them is the report has to be made by within 24 hours, and it has to be made through an electronic means. Either if you use the Campaign Finance Board's Campaign Finance Reporter, which is a software that does that automatically for you, you can use that, you can send in a fax, or you can also do it in person. We also extend that law to political committees, political caucuses, and political committees, setting a threshold for disclosure reporting at $800. So any contribution made to one of those entities that exceeds $800 needs to be reported within 24 hours and by an electronic means. The Campaign Finance Board is directed with their support of posting those reports of extraordinary contributions on their website. Why $800? Another change that's made in the bill is to the level of contributions that may be received, the maximum amount of contributions that may be received by the statewide candidates for the offices of Secretary of State and State Auditor. Currently, they are at the level of during an election year at the level of state legislators, and this bill moves their contribution limit to the same level as it exists for the Attorney General. And then we used an 80%, because we have 80%, as an appropriate threshold for reporting. We did not make any change or suggest any change, however, to the contribution limit that is available for the governor and lieutenant governor, just moved those other two offices to the same level as attorney general, and then required everyone other than legislators who were at the $400 threshold to report an extraordinary contribution. We also reviewed with the Campaign Finance Board another issue that has come up with regard to campaign finance reporting, and that is the affidavit of contributions. We noticed, or they noticed, and we responded to it, that there are any number of campaigns that after they file, or after the reporting date is cut off, that only after that do they file their affidavit of contributions. And there were some, I don't know if I have that sheet right in front of me, there were some 37 candidates who filed reports at the cutoff date for August 21st who did not show at that point sufficient contributions that could have led them to file an affidavit of contributions. So to gently close a loophole, which we think exists, and we've heard from any number of folks about it, that what this bill proposes is that the filing of contributions, of the affidavit of contributions, and the cutoff point for reporting for the primary, which is the reporting that triggers the public subsidy amounts, that they're going to be the same. So in last year's election, it would be you need to report your affidavit of contributions no later than August 21st, and your August 21st cutoff date would be showing that you had achieved the level which would sustain the affidavit of contributions. Now, it might still be that since you're just reporting a total, that some people might not be completely transparent in the reporting of the eligibility of all of those contributors. But this is a step toward making sure that, for example, the extreme example is a person filing their report with a cutoff date of August 21st, showing $150 collected, no money expended, and they get the public subsidy because they filed after that. The filing date right now, deadline is August 31st. All of a sudden, if they were running for the Senate, they would have, within that 10-day period, raised $3,000 that would have qualified them. So we're just trying to put a little bit more teeth into the affidavit of contributions, and we're doing that with the support of the campaign finance board that, among others, has pointed that out to us as an issue that the legislature needs to address. So the bill deals with extraordinary contributions, disclosure, no changing of who's eligible or how much, except for those two statewide offices, and then also deals with the affidavit of contributions and the filing of reports.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Rest. Are there questions from committee members? No questions? Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rest, maybe a question. Was the reason for changing the Secretary of State and the Auditor to 1,000 just so that they would have some chance to report some large contributions? Or because I question why that takes them only 200 people statewide could finance their entire campaign here.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Marty, that was an issue that was discussed in the subcommittee, and it seemed like to me that it made all kinds of sense to have the statewide officers not be to be on the same same level playing field. Senator Marty had pointed out in the subcommittee that if they were running statewide campaigns only at $500, that we should not change that amount. But I thought in the name of equity for their campaigning and their level of campaign expenditures that it was appropriate to raise their contribution limit to $1,000. And he's quite right that if we did not have it any higher, then they would not ever have to report an extraordinary contribution because they are not covered by our $500 limit.
Senator Marty, anything else?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Rest, I don't think that's a good reason for raising it, but I think the rest of the bill is good. Okay.
Further questions? Okay, is there anybody from the public that wants to comment on the bill? Seeing none in the lateness of the hour. Well,
Mr. Chairman, Thank you. We're still 5 minutes under our time. But if there is none, then I would move that Senate File 123 as amended be recommended to pass. And it doesn't, we haven't gotten a notice that it needs another stop.
Okay. So, all right. Senator Rest renews her motion for Senate File 123 to pass as amended and go to the Senate floor. All those in favor, say aye.
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 Those opposed? The motion carries.
And members, I would just point out that on Wednesday we have a fairly full agenda of bills to be heard, and so the whole committee time will be devoted to that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, and the committee is adjourned.
There you go.